I really feel the pressure is it's a great group, and they've been performing at a very high level with Mike and before that with Al. And, you know, the standard is remarkably high. I mean, talking about Keith Jackson and Frank Gifford and Al Michaels and Mike, you know, people expect the very best because that's as good as it gets. So I do feel the pressure, I guess, or whatever, the expectation to perform at that level. And I don't mean to be a jerk, but I feel like I'm capable of doing that. And I think the people at ESPN feel I'm capable of doing that, or they wouldn't have given me this opportunity, because there's certainly several other men and women who would have happily filled this role. So, you know, I had some fairly intense and intensive surgery on my brain and inner ear about 3.5 years ago.
Right.
You know, that's pressure. That's, the doctors and the nurses and the anesthesia people who did all that, that's pressure. You know, getting on there and calling a football game, even if it is with a large audience, to me isn't really that big a deal.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And our guest this week is the Monday Night Football, and that is a new tag. The Monday Night Football broadcaster, Sean McDonough, who has been at ESPN for a long time, fantastic game caller of college football and college basketball, and has recently been named as the lead announcer of the Monday Night Football package with Jon Gruden as Mike Tirico moves from ESPN to NBC. Sean McDonough has done a lot of really interesting things in the business, big college football games, big college basketball games. When he was 30, he called the World Series on CBS in, I believe, 1992 and 1993. So he's had an interesting career. And, of course, he's the son of Will McDonough, the famous Boston Globe writer who became the first NFL information person on television, has family in the NFL, brother who's a vice president of personnel for the Cardinals, GM of the, he's got another brother who's a GM of the Phoenix Suns. And so he's going to be an interesting guest, and I appreciate him coming on today, given that Trace got a lot of interview commitments. My thanks to you guys for listening to the previous podcast. Adnan Virk, by the way, who was the last guest, is now the most listened to podcast that we've ever done. It just got amazing pickup both on Stitcher and some other places. And so thank you very much for that. All right, let's keep these intros short, and let's bring in Sean McDonough of ESPN on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Sean, we know you've been on quite an interview tour today. Rich Eisen, I know you just hung up with, so we appreciate the time of clearly a very busy man.
Well, obviously, any of those previous interviews were just to warm up here for the main event, so I'm excited to be with you, Richard. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. That's very flattery, Sean, is very nice. It's always appreciated.
Yeah, try to soften them up early so they don't come out with the sharp objects right away.
Right. We're in the print business here, or the digital business, Sean. It's not like television, so we need all the flattery we can get. We're not used to being treated as talent. All right, first off, Sean, congratulations, obviously, on what is you know, an incredibly legacy gig. But before we get into Monday Night Football, having been on the conference call with you that you did recently when this announcement was made and doing some research on your career, it's interesting to me that you were clearly never sure if it was going to come around for you again in terms of being the lead on a package. You were the lead on CBS's coverage of the World Series in the early 90s, but you were very young. And while you had great assignments, that lead, being a lead on a package, had not come around again. So how frustrated were you that over the course of your last 15, 20 years, while the assignments were great, you weren't the lead of a package the way a Tirico is, or the way a Fowler is?
Well, I was fairly frustrated. You know, I kind of alternated between that and then the reality, which really, Richard, most of the time was I was very fortunate to be doing the things that I was doing. And yeah, there were maybe a few guys in our business who were a rung above me, and they're all great. You know, the Jim Nances and Mike Tirico's, Al Michaels, Joe Bucks of the world. But there are an awful lot of people who would just love to do all of the events that I was doing, you know, major bowl games and the U.S. Open golf and British Open and Major League Baseball and Big Mondays. You know, so I felt most of the time when I'd be frustrated, I would quickly give myself the reality check that, you know, the vast majority of people in our business would love to do the events that I was doing. So, you know, I kind of alternated between the two of them, but for the most part, I always just felt very blessed to be able to do what I do.
Sean, it struck me that in terms of performance, you know, your performance was there and certainly good enough, at least in my opinion, and it's all subjective, but in my opinion, to lead a broadcast or a package, I should say. One of the things, though, that you are not or were not is overtly self-promotional and putting yourself out there in positions where you might become as well-known as the people who are leading packages. Mm-hmm. Do you think you were hurt at all by being someone who was not the most active person, let's say, in social media or the most active in doing interview after interview? And I don't even mean this pejoratively, in the way other broadcasters do to elevate their career.
Maybe, but if that's the case, then I'm perfectly content with that. You know, I really believe that we are there on the air calling these games, hopefully to add to people's enjoyment of the game and not detract from it. Me, if I had to summarize our job, that's it. And it's not about us. And you know, I get very uncomfortable when I watch sports television. It seems like the broadcasters are clearly trying to call attention to themselves. You know, I just don't think it's appropriate. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a sense of humor, you can't give each other a hard time, you can't tell a well-placed story if the moment allows, but you know, for the most part, we're there to chronicle the game, provide some information, hopefully a few light moments along the way, and that's it. So, and maybe it's growing up around my dad, who, as you know, was the sports writer for the Globe, Boston Globe, for a long time and transitioned to TV as an information man. He was probably the least self-promotional person I've ever been around. Matter of fact, I remember as a kid, you know, there were different organizations that wanted to honor him or give him awards, and he just wouldn't do it because he didn't want to call attention to himself. So maybe that's part of my DNA. But, you know, maybe if I had done more of that stuff, some of these things might have happened sooner. But I just am not comfortable doing that.
Sean, you and Mike Tirico share the same agent. Did you know he was leaving ESPN before ESPN did?
No, I probably had an inkling before they did. But the last time that Mike and I really spoke seriously about it, he was out in Arizona, and we got together and played golf and went to dinner. And that was probably about a month and a half before all of this happened. And at that point, Mike said he was about 80% sure he was staying at ESPN. I mean, he and I had talked about the possibility that if he did leave, Monday Night Football might open up for me. I had certainly heard some scuttlebutt within the company that if Mike left, I would be the likeliest candidate to take his place. But when he told me that about a month and a half ago, I had really stopped thinking about it. I was just focused on my new deal, and I was going to have a few new and different assignments that I was excited about. But out of the blue, I got the phone call from John Wildhack, our boss at ESPN, that Mike was leaving, and Monday Night Football was open, and I was at the top of his list, and obviously the world changed very quickly.
Do you know if Mike advocated for you once he made that
decision? But I'm reasonably sure that he did. You know, we've all been together at ESPN long enough. You know, I know that John Wildhack knows how Mike feels about me. You know, Richard, you're talking about not being a self-promoter and not putting yourself out there. And what I really care about, and I apologize if this does sound self-indulgent, but what I've really cared about more than anything else, I guess, through the years when it comes to that stuff is not to blow smoke up your skirt, but, you know, what people who understand the business think or say. And one of the nicest compliments I've ever had, Mike was speaking up at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University, and he did a big, you know, kind of auditorium-style Q&A with a couple hundred students. And one of the students asked him, said, "I want to be a play-by-play announcer, and what advice would you give me?" And Mike's answer was, "Watch Sean McDonough." And Lynn Vanderhook, who's the assistant dean of Newhouse, called me later that day to tell me that story. And it meant the world to me because, if people like Mike, who are at the very top of our business, feel that way, then to me, there's no better compliment than you can receive. So, Mike's always been a great supporter. I wound up on the British Open because Mike told the people at ESPN when we went from having part of the British Open, when we went from having part of the British Open to having all of the British Open, Mike went to the powers that be and said, we're going to need more announcers because we're going to be on a lot longer and you need to get Sean on here. So they said, good idea. We'll give him a call. So that's the kind of friend Mike is. And to me, the nicest part of this is that it's not happening for me at the expense of somebody else. A lot of times when something good happens in your professional life, no matter what you do, it's at the expense of somebody else. Mike is going on to something that's going to be awesome for him. And, we're both happy about what's transpired, and that doesn't always happen.
Sean, obviously, I'm asking you to be speculative on something, but I think most people who write about this stuff, report about this stuff, and even beyond that, I think if you're just a fan of sports broadcasting, you look at NBC and you think Mike Tirico looks like the logical successor to Al Michaels whenever Al decides to step down. Do you believe that is a sort of a legitimate assessment? And it's not.
I think it certainly is. Although I think the reason Mike felt a month and a half ago that he was 80% sure he was staying is that Al and Bob, at least to me, and I know to Mike, don't seem like they're anywhere close to the finish line. I know people speculated about it because I think Al is in his early 70s and Bob is in his mid 60s, but you're talking about two of the people who are among the, the greatest of the all-time greats at what they do. And in my opinion, they're still at the top of their game. So I think that's the way Mike looked at it. But I think NBC is going to give him enough prominent events to do until that day comes. And Mike's only 49 years old, so it's not like he needs to do these things next week. But whenever that day comes, I would be very surprised if Mike is not in that Sunday Night Football chair and doing a Super Bowl and probably hosting the Olympics too. But were I NBC, I wouldn't be in any hurry to do that because Al and Bob are still, they're on the Mount Rushmore and their performances are still worthy of that.
It's well said. You mentioned this. You signed an extension prior to the Monday Night Football opening. And I wonder, obviously, without giving specific contractual data away, to give people some insight, is this a process then where your agent now negotiates a whole new deal when the company says, Sean, your primary job now is going to be Monday Night Football, and even though we had previously signed you to do X, your whole world has changed? So without, I think, because this is a media podcast and people are really interested in this.
Yeah, I'm happy.
How does it work behind the scenes without obviously giving us dollar figures?
Well, one of the reasons I admire Sandy Montag as much as I do, my agent and Mike's and many others who you referenced earlier, who I think is wonderful and a really good person. Sandy and I were having some of these conversations that you alluded to earlier about, the frustration of not moving to another level. And I kept saying to him, I really want to sign another 4-year deal to stay if I'm going to be kind of stuck on this level, one rung below the absolute top level. And, like me, Sandy believed John Wildhack when he said this opportunity is going to come eventually. It's just a matter of finding the right one. But he was also in a tough spot because, he talks to Mike all the time and he represents Mike and he doesn't want to violate my confidentiality as a client or Mike's. So, I think he was in a very nice way trying to tell me if something opens, we've had assurances that they'll redo your deal. So let's sign the deal because it's a good deal based on what you're doing now. And if your situation changes, we've had assurances that they'll rip up the deal and do another one. So that's what happened. John Wildhack called me on a Monday. Jay Rothman, the producer, came to Arizona 3 days later, Thursday. They offered me the job that evening, and the next day Sandy was on the phone and renegotiated the deal and was done within less than 24 hours of when Jay Rothman was at my house. So,
wow.
They ripped it up and did it over again.
Has ESPN management, Sean, told you in terms of how long they expect you to be on Monday Night Football? Or have they given you any kind of parameters like, Sean, where, you know, we are investing in you and John Gruden for the next 3 years, 5 years, 7 years?
Well, my contract's for 4 years. I think we have it for six more.
I think that sounds right. Yep.
You know, my existing contract, the one that we ripped up, had just started. It had been in place for about a month, and it was for 4 years. So they basically just used that as the foundation and changed, you know, some of the assignments and the dollars around. But, you know, my three predecessors, you know, Keith Jackson, as you know, Richard, did it for 1 year the first year. And then
right.
Frank Gifford and Al Michaels and Mike Tirico combined to do 45 years. So, you know, if the average is 15 years... I'd sign up for that right now and go happily into Never Never Land when we're finished.
Sean, you're someone with, I mean, you know, hours and hours and hours of reps when it comes to broadcasting, and reps in very, very big assignments. That said, I will ask you, are you feeling any pressure about the upcoming assignment, given that the stakes are higher than what you're used to, and maybe the only parallel that you have goes back, you know, 20 plus years to the right. Calling those World Series games.
Yeah, I remember being anxious. I don't know if nervous is the right word, but, you know, anxious. Certainly back then, when I was 30, very few people nationally had any idea who I was, but people in New England knew, because I've been doing the Red Sox games for 5 or 6 years on local TV. And I had done some network TV for both ESPN and CBS prior to the playoffs and World Series in 92. But you know, I knew I was going to be under a lot of scrutiny. And obviously there's less scrutiny back then, because that was before social media and some of the other forms of media that exist now that weren't around back then. And I do remember being anxious. I'm lucky that I'm not a person who gets particularly rattled by being on TV or nervous. I think once you settle in, you know, everybody, I think, Richard, would admit to at the start of the game. I mean, I've done I don't know how many games, thousands of games, but, you know, if you get to the point where right before the game, you don't have a little, you know, extra quickness of your pulse, then it's probably, as they say, time to go do something else. So that happens anyway. Where I really feel the pressure is, it's a great group, and they've been performing at a very high level with Mike, and before that with Al, and, you know, the standard is remarkably high. I mean, talking about Keith Jackson and Frank Gifford and Al Michaels and Mike, you know, people expect the very best, because that's as good as it gets. So I do feel the pressure, I guess, or whatever, the expectation to perform at that level. And I don't mean to be a jerk, but I feel like I'm capable of doing that. And I think the people at ESPN feel I'm capable of doing that, or they wouldn't have given me this opportunity, because there's certainly several other men and women who I would have happily filled this role. So, yeah, there's going to be some scrutiny. But I think all this stuff that we've talked about, you know, the ups and downs and kind of the interesting career path and frustrations and exhilaration, one of the things that it's taught me is this really is the toy store of life. I mean, we're talking about sports and we're talking about television. You know, as you know, I had some fairly intense and intensive surgery on my brain and inner ear about 3.5 years ago.
Right.
You know, that's pressure. That's the doctors and the nurses and the anesthesia people who did all that. That's pressure. You know, getting on there and calling a football game, even if it is with a large audience, to me isn't really that big a deal.
How is your health these days, Sean?
It's really good. Thank you. You know, blessed to live in a city like Boston. We have some of the best medical care in the world, and, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, and I don't know how interested you are in this or your listeners are, so I'll try to make it brief, but which would be uncharacteristic for me, as I've demonstrated already, but I had a condition called superior canal dehiscence syndrome, which is basically a genetic thing that you're born with, but you really don't become aware of it until later in life. For the most part, the bone between your brain and your inner ear is abnormally thin, and then as you get older, it gets thinner and thinner, and starts to develop holes, and then, you know, you start to hear your interior bodily noises. I could hear my heartbeat. I could hear my eyeballs move. My footsteps were really loud in my ear, because your bodily noises come through your skeletal system and through that hole in the bone into your ear from the inside of your body. So your voice sounds abnormally loud in your own head, which obviously is really jarring when you do what I do for a living. So, and a lot of people get really bad vertigo. I was lucky. I just had minor dizziness, but some people, you know, the world is spinning for them constantly. So it's major surgery to fix it. They have to remove a part of your skull above your ear, in my case, my left ear, lift your brain because it sits on the bone that needs to be patched. They take some of the fragments from the part of your skull that they've temporarily removed and use those to patch the bone and thicken it so it doesn't happen again. And then they move your brain back into place and reattach your skull. In my case, that surgery took about 4.5 hours, and I was in the hospital for about 5 days. But the good part of it is it's a very underdiagnosed phenomenon. It really only got figured out by the medical people 20 years ago. They used to tell people if they could hear their eyeballs move that the psychiatrist was down the hall. And these doctors at Johns Hopkins figured it out, and the surgery is still kind of a work in progress. And there aren't that many people who had it, but I've had emails and phone calls from people all over the world who have read my story and have reached out for advice, or they want to know what the surgery is like. And one case, a woman in Florida had had these symptoms for 24 years and didn't know what was going on. The doctors couldn't figure it out. They told her she was a crazy person, and she Googled, "I can hear my eyeballs move," and a story that was written about me in USA Today came up, and the light went off for her, and she called my doctor in Boston and came up to see him, and she wound up having that surgery on both sides. So there are a lot of good things that came out of what was really difficult experience at the time.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the problem is that I might have to have it on the other side. When they do these intensive CAT scans, you know, the bone on my right side, the non-surgical side, is really, really thin. So I'm always kind of anxious about the possibility that I could sneeze one day and the next thing you know, the same thing's going to be happening on the other side. So, if that happens, then we'll deal with it when it comes. But it's a tough deal to go through. And I was fortunate in one way that, you know, my symptoms were a lot less intense than some of these other poor people who suffer with it and continue to suffer with it.
Well, we'd certainly wish you the best of luck on that. It's going to be a weird segue here to sort of get off that, which is a serious health concern. And that is one of the things, Sean, that you talk to enough broadcasters, you learn that so much of the chemistry with their on-air group is done off-air in dinners, in just hanging out, in talking at people's homes. And so you, I know you've met Gruden a couple of times in some social situations, not a ton, but a couple. But one of the things that was interesting about Tirico and Gruden is that they became really close friends. And whether you like them as a pair or not, you could not say that they didn't have chemistry on air. And I think a lot of that is because they liked each other. So have you thought about, or even have you at this point started heading down the line of how you and John could try to find that chemistry maybe away from the broadcast so that it develops on the broadcast?
Well, I don't agree with the premise because I really don't like Jay Billis or Bill Raftery or Chris Spielman. No, I think it's critically important, and you're exactly right. You know, most of the chemistry that you develop is a product of the time that you spend together off the air. I mean, Billis and Raftery and I had more fun off the air than three people should be allowed to have. I mean, it really paves the way to the same kind of rapport and chemistry on the air. And really the same is true with just about anybody I've ever worked with. So John and I are actually, as we speak, we're going to see each other in New York for an ESPN event next week. And we're already talking about, I'm going to get down to Florida for a few days and spend some time with him. Really interested to see his setup that I've seen on the Gruden quarterback camps. And I've heard a lot about where he's in the bunker at 4 a.m. every day watching film. And I'm hoping to get him up here to Boston and play a little golf this summer and just hang around, because I think that is important. But we'll also have a lot of time together as the season goes along. As you know, we get in there a few days ahead of time to begin preparation. You're in and out of meetings, and you're on the Monday night bus, and you're in the hotels and going to dinner. And I think it'll come along pretty quickly. John is not, from what I've seen, a very hard guy to get to know. You know, some people, it takes a while for them to open up to anybody, but John isn't one of those guys, nor am I. So I think that'll happen pretty quickly. And Mike Tirico has told me the same thing.
Yeah, Jay Billis and Bill Rafter were both podcast guests, and each demanded that you be third on that list, Sean. So that's why you're.
Well, you know what? They're both tied for second when it comes to picking up a check on Monday night over the years. I can tell you that. But if you've had the podcast with those two on, you still have any listeners, that is a major accomplishment on your part.
We've had to do a lot of marketing, but we're still on the air, thankfully.
Amen.
With the NBA playoffs in high gear, SI's own Splash Brothers, Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver, my God, who wrote that copy, are doing multiple shows a week on Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. These guys watch unhealthy amounts of basketball and lay out all the best drama and the best storylines. That's Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. Find it on your podcast client of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and always at si.com/podcasts. One of the things that happens on this podcast a lot, Sean, is that we talk about process and how people go about their jobs. It's always fascinating to me the approach that play-by-play people take when it comes to preparation and research, because it's different depending on who you are. Some people love to have these in-depth charts for their games. Others, their charts are not, not as complex and complicated. Some people love to like talk to every coach and every player they can. Others don't. So for you, as someone who's done multiple events, but lately a lot of high-level college basketball and high-level college football, you can be as specific and go as long as you want on this, because I think a lot of young people are interested when they hear this. How do you prepare for a broadcast? If you're, let's say, getting assigned to Michigan, Ohio State, and the game is next Saturday, and I'm talking to you on a Saturday, what's that process like for you to get ready for
it? Yeah, it's a week-long process, especially football. Football is by far the most intensive in terms of the preparation. It's just really because of the number of people who might appear in the game, particularly in a college game when each team might dress 99 guys. Obviously, that's minimized with the roster limits in the NFL, but for me, it usually starts on Sunday. I'll allow myself a little time off on the flying home either Saturday night or Sunday morning. But, then you start reading the clips that you get. You start watching the tapes of recent games that the teams that you're going to have the following Saturday have played in. Our typical week in college football with our group was on Wednesday. We would do a conference call on the phone with the head coach, offensive and defense coordinator of the visiting team, and the head coach would be more general topics, the coordinators would be more strategy on their side of the ball, and we have them go through the depth chart, make sure we had it right, who's going to play, and then give us a couple of sentences about each player, strengths, weaknesses, anything else that they think is interesting about them. And then we try to get a few of the players on the phone. Some of the schools wouldn't give you access to players, others would. Sometimes we do that visiting team conference call Friday night at their hotel when they got into town, if they prefer to do it that way. And we go to the home team's practice on Thursday, fly out Thursday morning, go to practice on Thursday afternoon. I didn't always go to practice if I couldn't get in on time. I think it's more important for the analyst than it is for me. But and then Friday we do all those meetings on the home team's campus in their football building, same sort of thing, head coach, coordinators, and players, talk to the SIDs and, read everything. But what I'm looking forward to with Monday Night Football is they have an amazing research group. Jim Carr does notes every week for them. Jay Rothman showed me his work. It's unbelievable. He basically reads everything that's ever been written about these two teams and weeds out all the stuff you don't need to know and just calls it down to stuff you do need to know. But it's still a very lengthy document. And Steve Hurt from the Elias Sports Bureau and his people are another research. So a lot of this stuff that I used to have to do for myself, I'm going to have a lot of help doing. And just the benefit of, when you go do an NFL game, who a lot of the players are, who the coaches are before you go. A lot of these college games, if it was a, middle of the road team, some weeks I start out, I don't know if I could name one player before we got the assignment on Sunday. So I think in many ways this will be easier in terms of the preparation just because of all the resources that we have at Monday Night Football.
Sean, one of the things that you probably were not judged on, you may not be judged on this as well, were ratings of college football games. Because ultimately, you get assigned a game, and I think people know Michigan, Ohio State's going to draw more than Central Florida versus TCU that week nationally. But Monday Night Football is a package where the viewership is important, and ESPN puts those numbers out every week, and people write about them, and they're paying attention to how that package is doing year over year. You in the end, Sean, as you know, both of us know, you can't control the viewership. So much of that is going to be based on what the matchup is and the quality of the game. But will you find yourself more interested in how many people are watching now that you're on this package as compared to what you previously had?
You know, maybe marginally so, just so I can rub it in Tirico's face if the ratings are better. but I really agree with your premise. I don't think we can do much. Now, you know, there are ways, you know, as you know, because you've heard the jargon for some of your time spent viewing is really important. If you can get people to stay for another 5 minutes, there's benefit in that. But ultimately what drives it is the matchups that you have. And I really think that we do have an advantage this year because, you know, as a Monday Night viewer in recent years, not all the games have been compelling. There's a couple matchups that you look at them ahead of time and say, wow, that's kind of a dog of a game, to be totally honest about it. But you know, as I look at our schedule this year, I don't really see any of those. You know, I went right through the list, and there wasn't one that I looked at and said, uh-oh, you know, that's a stink bomb, and we might have to do a little work to hold people's interest in that. So you hope that these teams that are on your schedule are as good as you think they're going to be, or at least have compelling storylines that might interest people heading into the game. As you know, the way the season unfolds, invariably there are teams that are a lot better than you thought they were going to be, or anybody else thought they were going to be, and there are teams that you thought would be really good and struggle for whatever reason. But as I look at our schedule now, months ahead of time, you know, I'm really excited about it, and I would think that potentially the ratings would just go up because of the compelling matchups that we have.
You referenced your father earlier, Will McDonough, who was a former Boston Globe writer, morphed into television, and pioneered the role of an NFL insider on TV. The Adam Schefters and Peter Kings and Ian Rappaport, they have this job because Will McDonough was the first person to do that on a national level. From reading about your upbringing, Sean, he, from what I understand, would bring you around as a young kid, and you would meet, whether it be Patriot broadcasters or Red Sox broadcasters, and you were as interested in them as you were in the players on the field.
Yes, from the very beginning, you know, my earliest memories of childhood. When my dad was much younger, when we were born, when I was born, I'm the oldest of five. You know, my dad covered all the sports. The seasons didn't overlap as much. And I remember going to spring training in Winter Haven, Florida, when my dad covered the Red Sox. And when I was in the first grade, second grade, we get out of school for a month and get homeschooled by my parents in the hotel. And then we'd head over to the ballpark, and my dad would have to, you know, walk around and cover the game, go down to the locker room. So he used to stash me in the back of the Red Sox radio booth. And really my first idols that I remember having were Ned Martin and Ken Coleman, Johnny Pesky, who were the Red Sox announcers, and treated me wonderfully. And what was really cool was, I don't know, decades later, when I was a Red Sox broadcaster, Ned was still doing some of the TV and Ken Coleman was on the radio. So these guys I had idolized my whole life really became my peers. And I really did know when I was four or five or six that this is what I wanted to do. My aunt got me a little tape recorder, and I used to sit in front of the TV and broadcast everything that would come on the TV. Boston Bruins games back in the Big Bat Bruins, Bobby Orr days, and Monday Night Football. My brother and sister used to dance around to the theme music as I would be doing my opening to Monday Night Football. So I used to drive my family crazy, I think, doing it, but my dad would very patiently listen to some of the tapes. So, yeah, that's great, Sean. Now, why don't you go out in the street and play like all the other kids? But, I benefited a lot from being around it. My dad was great about taking us around to things and exposing us to a lot of different experiences. And at the end of the day, he was the one who encouraged me to go into TV. When I first got to high school, I thought maybe I'd want to be a writer. And he was the one who saw newspapers starting to struggle all over the country. That was right around the time when, you know, cable TV was just sort of coming into existence, and ESPN was just starting, and NESN and all these, you know, regional pay cable networks. So he thought there'd be much more opportunity in TV and much less in print journalism, and obviously that turned out to be the case.
Hmm. You you have a brother who works for the Arizona Cardinals. I think he's you should tell me what his title is so I don't
he's
guess.
He's vice president of player personnel.
Right.
He's basically in charge of oversees all their scouting and is actively involved, obviously, in the draft with Steve Keim, their GM.
Right, major position in the Cardinals management. Do you have any other siblings who ended up in sports?
Yeah, I do. My sister Erin, who's between Terry and me, is vice president of Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, which is a world-class healthcare facility. Matter of fact, it was a lot of her resources that helped get my condition diagnosed 4 years ago. She's in charge of all their communications and public affairs, and if she's not the smartest person I know and the best person I know, I don't know who would be ahead of her. And then after Terry, there's my brother Ryan, who's the general manager of the Phoenix Suns.
Oh, that's right. I should know that. Right.
Our sister Cara has a big position at Under Armour. She's really the book smart one. She went to Harvard and Harvard Business School, and none of us and the rest of the family can really figure out how that happened. But so that's the five of us, and you'd like to think with what's going on with me that I might be at the top of the list, but I really think everybody in the family, including myself, views me as the slacker in the family. So I've got a little more to do here before I can catch up to the rest of them.
You're like the Colangelo dynasty with all those sports.
Yeah. What was really cool, there was a very nice article that was written recently and about the three brothers. And I think one distinction that we have that I'm not sure any other family could make is I have a World Series ring from 2004, which was my last year with the Red Sox when they ended the curse after 86 years and won the World Series. They were nice enough to give the broadcasters a ring. My brother Ryan has an NBA championship ring. He was with the Celtics as an assistant to Danny Ainge when they won the NBA championship, their most recent one. And Terry has a Super Bowl ring from when he was a scout with the Baltimore Ravens when they won the Super Bowl when they beat the Giants. I think that was in 2000. So, there's three boys in the family, and we each have a world championship ring from different sports. I always say the difference is my two brothers had something to do with those teams winning the championship, where I just sat in the booth and said, ball three, two outs. My role really wasn't much of a factor in the Red Sox winning the World Series.
Do you, in today's broadcasting now, I think companies are comfortable with siblings calling the games of siblings or family being assigned to games of family. There's a long journalistic kind of debate as to whether that should be the case or not, but the fact is the ESPNs and the Fox and the CBSs have seem to not have a problem with that. How do you approach it if you end up doing a Cardinals game?
Well, we will, because they're on the schedule in October. They're hosting the Jets. So that'll come up. It'll come up for John again, the very first game of the year. We're going to be in Washington.
Yeah, with Jay, right.
Obviously, his brother is Jay Gruden, is the coach of the Redskins. So, it's I guess we'll deal with it when we come to it. I'd like to think I have enough experience. I love Syracuse, and I have remained very actively involved as an alum at Syracuse. So, and I've done a lot of Syracuse basketball games and a few football games over the years. So I have plenty of experience trying to weed the emotional side of it and the attachment to it and potential bias and get that out of the equation, hopefully. I know there are still some Georgetown people in particular who think that I'm not quite doing a good job of hiding my bias when it comes to Syracuse. But I'm very respectful of the fact that you owe the audience a straight down the middle, unbiased call. There's nothing worse than when you're watching a game and you're a fan of one team and you have the feeling that the announcers are kind of pulling for the other team. And I think it's very important to make sure that that doesn't happen. Remember, there have been times over the years when I thought I tried too hard to go the other way when it involves Syracuse. So it'll be tough, but I'm really used to it, Richard. I mean, when you're around as long as I've been, I'll be 54 tomorrow. You make a lot of friends. You cover people who you're close to, and some people you cover who you really don't have much use for. And you know, you learn to put that stuff aside, because the most important thing is giving a fair and honest and accurate account of the game.
Well, happy birthday in advance, Sean. All right, a couple more here. I'd love to know your your sort of reflections now that it's nearly a quarter century after the fact of replacing Jack Buck as the lead Major League Baseball play-by-play person. Jack had obviously had a great career before that, legendary figure in the sport, and it must have been odd, I imagine, at 30 years old or so, to come in, and even if you had nothing to do with it, to be the person replacing, a guy who was a Mount Rushmore type of guy.
Right. No, it was difficult. You know, you're excited to have the chance to do the World Series. You hate whenever it comes to the expense of somebody else. But if I didn't say yes, you know, somebody else was going to take Jack Buck's place. So the hardest part for me was, I didn't know him well, but every time I met him, he just so lived up to his already enormously large reputation as being a very nice, friendly, good, funny guy. A lot of people who are around him told me he might be the best banquet speaker they ever heard. And he's one of those broadcasters I idolize. And I just love the voice, and I love the, you know, he was one of those guys, when you watched the game, it felt like it was bigger because he was on it. And I used to love the old Monday Night Football on the radio that he did with Hank Stram. You know, Hank, who I worked with when I was at CBS, doing some regional game. You know, they're going to run to the right, Jack, and they pass to the left. And, it was sometimes it was good comedy, but they had great rapport. And, you know, one of the things that I loved the most about Jack Buck and think was one of his greatest among many strengths was he had a phenomenal knack for rising to the occasion at the big moments. I mean, it's rare. You can remember one or two calls at the end of games of any broadcaster, but, I think of the World Series when the home run was hit in Minnesota, and he said, "And we'll see you tomorrow night."
Right, right.
I thought it was cool when Joe emulated that kind of as a nod to his dad a few years later as the son of somebody in the same business. I got a little emotional when I heard him do that. And, I don't believe what I just saw, and, go crazy, folks, go crazy. You know, he had so many calls that were just perfect for the situation and made what were already huge moments that much bigger. And, I've gotten credit from you, and I appreciate it very much, and from other people about, having a knack for providing a good call, at the big moments. And I think that's one of the most important characteristics you can have. And it's one of the fun parts of it, because it's like playing. You only get one chance. You don't get a chance to hit delete and do it over again. It's there on the tape forever. So you either nail it or you botch it. And, you hope that it matches the moment. And I think Jack Buck was one of the greatest of all time at rising to the occasion in the big moments.
For the baseball fans out there, you have to check out SI's baseball podcast, The Strike Zone, with Ted Keith and Steve Canella. If you want to hear about the murderer's row of Mets pitchers, Max Scherzer striking out 20 Tigers, or the Cubs with the best record in baseball, check out The Strike Zone. It's a can't-miss podcast. You'll find The Strike Zone all summer long on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music. The entire SI network of podcasts can be found at si.com/podcasts. All right, Sean, one of the things I think the sort of the section I want to end on is asking you about a couple of the well-known games that you've called. And I think people would be surprised at how many big moments you've been part of. It's almost Lundquist-esque, Sean, the number of big moments you've had. First off, let's go to March 12th, 2009, UConn-Syracuse. Six overtimes, longest game in Big East history, 3 hours and 46 minutes. That was you, Raftery, and Billis. And my sense is, Sean, I mean, that, no one is saying that what we do is, we're not movers and we're not window-washing skyscrapers, but four-hour broadcast is, that's a grind physically. What do you remember about that?
Well, the hardest part, not to be overly forward, is that can't get up and go to the restroom.
Right, right.
It was too far away from where we were with the limited time during the TV commercials. But, you know, you run on adrenaline, and as you said, you're not digging ditches. So, but I think any time you're in a game like that, as a matter of fact, what I remember most is when it got over at about 1:30 in the morning, we had to do some wrap-ups and Sports Center hits. And then, shockingly, Raftery and Billis and I went and had a beer across the street. In fact, Bill had the funny line about it was the only time he's ever gotten home from New York after 3 in the morning and his wife wasn't mad at him. So, but then I went back to the hotel thinking I'd be exhausted, and I just was lying in the bed in the hotel room looking at the ceiling because, you know, your adrenaline's still flowing and your mind is just going through how remarkable the game was. So, whenever people ask me about the games that I did that I remember the most, you know, that one might be number one on the list in all honesty for because it was fascinating in just so many different ways.
It's interesting because I've taught, you know, in Mike Emmerich, Vern Lundquist, a number of play-by-play people have been on this podcast. They all say the same thing, that even hours later sometimes they're still wired if it's a really memorable game.
Yeah, that's what it was like for me. I mean, I was in the bed thinking I'm just going to be exhausted and fall right to sleep, and then it didn't happen. But, you know, I think, you kind of realize in the aftermath, my goodness, that was part of something really special and that people will be talking about for a long time, and they still do, as evidenced by this part of the conversation that we're having. And, you know, there was just so many, you know, that it was Syracuse and UConn with the history and the two Hall of Fame coaches, and that it was in Madison Square Garden, and so many other aspects to it. The most amazing thing about that game to me that probably gets lost over time is that in the first 5 overtimes, Syracuse was never ahead, ever. Not by 1 point for 1 second. They were either tied or behind. So they're playing with that pressure, playing from behind for the entire 25 minutes of game action. The first time they took the lead in any of the extra sessions was in the 6th overtime, which
wow.
To me made it truly amazing.
And I remember that. That's interesting. Heading way back to when you were 30, to me, the Francisco Cabrera at-bat in the 92 National League Championship Series, Game 7, that holds up still. I mean, you watch that, and yeah, listen, a broadcast in 1992 is going to look different than in 2016, but my sense would be that you should be proud of that because that's a call to me that even stands up 25 years later.
Oh, I appreciate that, and I feel that way. And again, it's one of those things where you never know how it's going to be perceived. That was probably the first of my several famous or infamous voice cracks now, but what I remember about that was, you know, and Steve Hurt from the Elias Sports Bureau, who's a expert on history of these things, thinks it's one of the greatest baseball games ever played, and I would agree with him. You know, there was so much at stake. It was, for Pittsburgh, it was sort of the last hurrah. Everybody knew that nucleus with Bonds and Jim Leland, you know, they weren't all going to stay there together anymore. It might be their last chance, and Atlanta was a big favorite in the series, and Pittsburgh got to Game 7 and had the lead in the 9th inning, and you know, there was an error by Chico Lean at second base for the Pirates, which never happened. But anyway, you know, because it was so loud and you're just screaming as Sid Bream crossed the plate, you know, I mean, I knew my voice cracked and I thought, I mean, I kind of botched the call. And my friend Billy Andrade is a PGA Tour golfer now on the Champions Tour. He lives in Atlanta. He and his wife Jody were in the booth. And, you know, the game ended and we did the post game, and the post game was memorable too because that was the night that Deion Sanders threw buckets of water all over.
Oh,
Tim
wow.
Carver.
I didn't know that. It's crazy. Right.
In the locker room. So we're walking down through the concourse, and I said to Billy and Jody Andrade, you know, oh boy, that might be the biggest moment I ever call. And I think I kind of kicked it. My voice was, you know, breaking. And we got down the trucks, and there's Tim, you know, who's angry because he's doused with water from head to toe. And then, you know, Neil Pilsen, who was the president of CBS
right.
Sports at the time, wasn't a real emotional guy. And he grabbed me and he said, that was the greatest call, and it matched the moment perfectly. And love it. You know, that's going to be up there with the Giants win the pennant, which clearly it's not, but I appreciated him saying that anyway. And so I looked at Billy and Joe, okay, you know, maybe I didn't botch it. So, you know, with the passage of time, you know, I'm pleased with the way that whole thing played out.
Sean, do you remember the moments or the seconds right before Joe Carter hit his home run to win the 93 World Series? Because, again, you are one of the few broadcasters who ever had the experience of calling a World Series ending home run.
Yeah, you know, you're not really sitting there thinking he's going to hit a home run and the game's going to be over. You know, you're always trying to keep track of the situations. You know, if the ball is hit through a certain field, you know, how strong is the outfielder's arm, or, you know, those sorts of things. But, you know, you're not really thinking he's going to swing, and with one swing of the bat, the one team is going to go from winning to losing and win the World Series. So, yeah, I think my call of that hopefully reflected almost the surprise in my voice as it went over the fence and the suddenness of the ending. You know, I felt really lucky. My friend Craig Silver, who is a producer at CBS Sports, I did the college football with him for when I did the SEC games. Craig called me years later, and he said when Warren Morris hit the home run for LSU to win the College World Series, he said, you know, in the history of the College World Series and the Major League World Series combined, they've only ended on a home run three times, and you called two out of the three. I wasn't there for Bill Mazeroski. I wasn't born yet, but, you know, I hadn't thought of that, and I thought, my goodness, you know, you talk about the good fortune of just being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. 96, Warren Morris hits a two-out, ninth-inning home run to win the College World Series for LSU. You and Steve Garvey. Right? Am I correct about that?
I think so. Yeah. You know, every year that I did the World Series, it seemed like there was a different analyst, both at CBS and ESPN. I mean, the list of it, if I sat her off the top of my head, you know, it's a long, long list. Jeff Torborg and Fred Lynn and Joe Carter and Barry Larkin when I was at ESPN, Robin Ventura, many, many more. Jerry Kendall, who was the coach at Arizona. I mean, there was a bunch of them. So I kind of lose track of who was there when, but I think it was Steve Garvey, and I'm pretty sure Michelle Tafoya was on the field.
Wow.
Matter of fact, my annoyance in that, to be totally candid, is, you know, the game ends. It ends on a home run by a guy who hadn't hit a home run all year, and we had told the story. Warren Morris was a really good player, and Skip Bertman was the coach, and he had told us in the meetings, you know, he felt bad for Warren because he had some power, but he had hurt his hand or wrist earlier in the year and it never really recovered. And he was a left-handed hitter. And Skip said he really can't pull the ball with any authority, so he just kind of keeps slapping the ball to the opposite field, the left field. So, of course, he gets up there and turns on one and pulls it with a lot of authority. As a matter of fact, I think the only question was if it would actually clear the fence, because it was a line drive that didn't get over the fence by much, although it got out of the park in a split second. And the annoying part to me was we went off the air without interviewing him, which is criminal. And we were rushing to get off because the people at CBS back in New York wanted us to hurry up and get to the third round of whatever the golf tournament was. I think it might have been the Westchester Classic or something. You know, it wasn't even the last round. So I didn't think that was a great television decision, but it was one of the most memorable games that I've ever called, for sure. Matter of fact, I just did a radio show in New Orleans or Baton Rouge because it was the anniversary of that home run, the 20th anniversary of that. And they had the whole team, I think, back in Baton Rouge for the weekend.
Nice. All right, and the final one I want to ask you about just happened this past year, so relatively recent, and that is the Michigan State game, where I think everybody thought that Michigan had the game wrapped up. And then it's a botched punt. Michigan State gets the botched punt. I don't remember if they scored with no time on the clock, or maybe there was like a second or so.
Yeah, I think they crossed the goal line with no time.
No time on the clock.
I don't remember them kicking off or anything.
Right.
After that.
So that's, Sean, as you know, has become a massive rivalry game in the Big Ten. You know, you could play that game 100 years. It's not going to end like that ever again. And once again, I thought you, and I had written this at the time, I thought you and Chris Spielman totally lived up to that moment and had a terrific broadcast. But in all your college football calls, I mean, that has to be, there certainly has to be the craziest ending. It might not be the best game you've ever seen, but you're never going to get an ending like that again.
No, you know, it was unbelievable. And I appreciate what you said. You know, I thought Chris did a phenomenal job of setting the whole thing up. As a matter of fact, right before the snap, he said, something along the lines of, you know, just catch it and just take one step and get it off. Don't worry about your mechanics. Just catch it and one step and kick it. So, you know, he kind of set up the possibility of, you know, something bad happening if the punter didn't do what Chris suggested he needed to do. And, You know, again, it was when my voice was kind of all over the place, but I think it was just reflective of the astonishment and excitement of the moment. I think, you know, we had some unbelievable reaction shots from our crew of the disbelieving fans on both sides. And it really was, you know, you stood there for a while after thinking, what the heck did we just watch? What just happened? So, and I'm grateful for it. You know, some years you get lucky and you get a lot of really great matchups and games that go down the wire and have endings like that. And sometimes it feels like you go a whole season, you never have a good game. But, you know, with the beginning of that season, our first game of the year was Mike Riley's debut as the Nebraska coach. And, of course, they lost on a Hail Mary against BYU
right
on the last play of the game. And in all honesty, you know, Chris and I are really appreciative of your recognizing us, and along with Todd McShay and our producer, Bo Garrett, and the rest of our group as the broadcast team of the year for last year. And, you know, we're really proud of that. It meant a lot to us and still does. But, you know, part of that is what we just talked about. You know, you have to wind up in the right place, you know, because your group doesn't necessarily get much attention if every game you have is just kind of ho-hum. So the fact that we were fortunate enough to be in those places, I think, led to a lot of the positive response that we got, including from you, which, again, I said it was much appreciated.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, obviously you have to do really great games to sort of be in that sort of that possibility of those kind of you know, those kind of honors, if you even want to call my column an honor. The last thing, just on this, Sean, and then I'll ask you, I'll James Lipton it for you. I'll ask you my last question I like to ask people. And that is, Chris Spielman, to me, is a really excellent analyst. But here's what's interesting about Chris, and you know him far, I don't know him at all. I think maybe we've talked once. But the thing that is always interesting to me about Chris is that his style of broadcasting is very different than what I think most executives want from an analyst these days. And that's personality. And that's, I'm not talking about John Madden, Boom, Ace Hardware, over the top, but they generally want people who are personalities, who can, who could, you know, who are humorous or who have a lot of charisma or who do some kind of shtick. Spielman, to me, is so about the nuts and bolts of the game. He clearly prepares. He's excellent, and particularly on explaining to the audience about defense. And I appreciate ESPN giving him high-profile games, because I don't know if this is just my premise. I could be way off, but I when you were going to be on, I did want to ask you this. Does he feel like something different to you as an analyst compared to so many analysts in other sports who are almost always asked to be personality-driven? I feel like Chris, Chris is always, if this makes any sense, he's like content and game-driven first and foremost. You may get a little personality after that, but he's a different kind of analyst than from what I'm used to seeing on TV.
Right. Well, I agree completely with all of that, you know, and I think the reason why he has maintained a high position at ESPN is because, you know, that's the message we get. You know, a lot of us bellyache that we have to go to these seminars all the time before the various seasons start, and they, you know, a lot of it is stuff that you've heard 100 times before. But, you know, one of the consistent themes, in, based on all the research and audience study that they do in focus groups, is that, you know, the ESPN audience is basically a hardcore sports, or in our case, hardcore football audience, and that's what they want. And, you know, that's what Chris gives them as well, if not better than anybody. I mean, and you're right, Richard, he prepares his rear end off, as does Todd McShay. You know, Todd McShay is another guy. When he came to us, I thought, okay, we'll go down to the sideline every now and then, and he'll tell us how this guy rates as a as an NFL prospect. But, you know, Todd played football at the University of Richmond. And when we watch film, you know, he has tremendous insight. Todd could be a booth analyst, but he's not just a one-trick pony on personnel evaluation. He really understands the nuts and bolts of football and strategy and the nuances of offense and defense. And, you know, he and Chris work really well together on that stuff. And it works just like Raftery and Billis work, because neither one of them has any kind of ego about it. And some guys in the booth might be threatened by a field analyst who's, you know, interjecting on the football part, but Chris encourages it and welcomes it and is really happy when Todd makes a great point. The hard part for me, Richard, of leaving and going to Monday Night Football, and there's really very few hard parts to it, but if there is a hard part, it'd be leaving Chris and leaving Todd and Bo Garrett and Mike Schwab, our director. Bo Garrett's our producer, and our crew, because you really do become a family and a team. And I've never worked with anybody who's more about team than Chris. And I've never been around a better person than Chris. You know, he's a devoutly Christian guy, a wonderful family person. I think a lot of people around the country know his story. His wife got diagnosed with cancer when he was in the middle of an all-pro career in the NFL, and he stepped away from football to go take care of his wife, who battled courageously for 11 years and unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But I don't know a better person than Chris. And I think the reason he's all the things that you said he is because he doesn't have an ounce of ego about him. Matter of fact, he hates when you call attention to him. He made the statement that on the Fiesta Bowl, the last game that we did together, that Joey Bosa, he thinks, is one of the top two defensive players in the history of Ohio State, and Antoine Winfield would be the other. And I just looked at him. I said, Chris, you know, there's a lot of people who would say that you are the best defensive player ever played at Ohio State. And he looked at me as if he was just like, please change the subject fast. And he meant it. And he's a wonderful guy. I think, if anything, he's underappreciated. And in all honesty, Richard, that's why your recognition of us meant a lot to me, because you know, as happy as I was to have whatever my performance was recognized, I think Chris has been deserving of this for a long time. And the fact that it came from somebody like you with your credibility and reputation meant a lot to him. It's one of the few things that I've ever actually heard him acknowledge along those lines that he actually thought was a cool thing.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me that he's a guy who wants to deflect attention from his playing career, which obviously at Ohio State was unbelievable, but that speaks to his MO. He's never been a guy, as long as I've covered media, who's self-promoted or put himself into a self-promotional position, which I particularly appreciate because the business is filled with many. And again, I'm not trying to be pejorative about that. That's just the honest truth. And Spielman always strikes me as genuine to sort of what he believes in terms of being a broadcaster. So that's pretty cool to hear that he's that carries over to different facets of his life.
He's belief me oriented. I mean, he's all about team, and he talks about it all the time. And he's not a real, for a guy who's very Christian, you know, I'm a big I love you person. I'm always telling my family and friends I love them. And you know, Chris can sometimes almost seem like he's uncomfortable with that, although he's softened up. But the last game we did in the Fiesta Bowl last year, I think he had an inkling one way or the other that this was going to be the last game that we did together. And we finished and we're gathering up our stuff. And I said, all right, buddy, ready to go? Because we were leaving together. And he looked at me and he said, and I'm going to get emotional again. He said, I don't want to leave the booth. I don't want this to end. And then he turned toward me and hugged me, which, you know, from Chris is was unexpected. So, he's a thoroughly honorable and decent, talented, kind human being with a great heart and a great family, man. And one of the great blessings of my professional life was working with him.
Yeah, that's I appreciate you sharing that. That's good to hear. All right, Sean, we've kept you way too long. So here's the
well, it's because I'm a long-winded loudmouth, but at least you're patient.
Well, the good news is, Sean, even with this long podcast, as my producer Bet will tell me, you're still like an hour behind Adnan Virk. So you're doing fine, Sean.
Oh, really?
Adnan? No, Adnan is the he's the Cecil B. DeMille of this podcast, given how long he went. So he's you're not going to top him.
He is a rising star in our business. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Very good dude, and very passionate about what he does, which is great.
Yeah, he's awesome.
All right, so Sean, here it is. I like to ask this question to broadcasters. I will allow you to call any sporting event in the history of the human race. So it could be one that has existed, like the 36 Olympic Games. It could be even something in the future, whatever you want to call the 2024 Super Bowl. So I want you to tell me what you would like to cover and why. And I will also allow you, if you want, to pick your analyst or analysts in the booth with you.
Wow. Whoa. Well, I think anybody in our business would want to do a Super Bowl. And I think it's the premier sporting event, obviously, in our country, and with the greatest audience. So, and I wouldn't care which one. I mean, it could be the next one. It could be one 10 years from now. I wouldn't care. Who would I take? Well, I would take, based on what I just said, how about we turn it into a three-man booth with Gruden and Chris Spielman?
Nice.
And I'd take Todd McShay on one sideline and Lisa Salters on the other.
You're already learning the politics of diplomacy with your selection, Sean. Well done.
Well, I'd like to be candid. I hope that I am, and I hope I have been as I've gone on and on here with you. But I also don't want to offend anybody, and I think that would be an awesome group, in all honesty. So let's go with that.
All right. Well, Sean McDonough has been the guest, as we've stated here. And at the top, he is the new voice of Monday Night Football, who do those games with John Gruden and Lisa Salters, Jay Rothman in the booth behind them. He's done college football, college basketball, called the World Series back in the day. Also, obviously, as people who will listen to this in the Boston and New England area know, was a longtime and fine Red Sox announcer. Sean, I'm really happy for you. I think, again, no bullshit here. You are one of, I think, the authentic and really good people craft-wise of what you do in the business. And it was really cool to see ESPN make the decision that they did. So I really wish you the best of luck. And I appreciate you coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, my pleasure, Richard. As I said, I appreciate your kindness. And it certainly doesn't hurt when executives are making decisions about who's going to do a job like this that you've written so many nice things. And really appreciative of it. I'm glad I've had a chance to get to know you a little bit better and look forward to continuing our relationship going forward. Thanks for having me.
You got it, Sean. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, back in the studio with Bette Marston. Bette, Sean McDonough, first of all, saying way too many nice things about me. I know that you enjoy mocking me when that happens.
Yeah, you've been getting that a lot recently. So I don't know. You should probably just keep doing what you're doing. And, you know.
It's whatever. It's, trust me. It's he's reading from a script. I know I say this a lot, but that was actually, that was a good podcast because we don't, or at least I haven't heard McDonough in like long form like that. And he gave you like a real sense of, I thought, of his career and why he's done and how he's done what he does. And it's just rare, I think, in the business for someone to, in his 50s, to get the big job after doing great work for like 10, 20 years. You know, oftentimes the people like Sean McDonough, they have excellent careers, but they never get the big job. But in this case, he's, like he said, it's Mike Tirico, Al Michaels and Sean McDonough. Those are the voices of Monday Night Football now for the last, whatever it's been, 35 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. And he kind of set up close to the top about how, you know, there's tons of expectations and there's, you know, big shoes to fill. And he kind of said as such, but at the same time, he has that confidence. He said, you know, I'm capable of fulfilling the expectations, and he seems to have a good grasp on everything. Deitch, we were also talking about this earlier. I really thought that he brought some good perspective with relation. He brings some good perspective with the job, and a lot of that has to do with his brain surgery that he was talking about, where he says, like, you know, what I'm doing out here is not a matter of life or death, whereas, you know, brain surgeons, they're doing, you know, work that literally is life or death. So, you know, he says that certainly helps him keep his whole job in perspective, and I thought that was really insightful.
Well, not just that, but also the fact that, like, this could come up again, given, you know, the other side of his brain. So, you know, knock on wood, that's not going to happen. All right, listen, we went long with Sean, so I'll make this very quick. My thanks to Sean McDonough, our guest, to Bette Marston, my producer, and to the usual group of people who have helped this podcast, from Paul Fichtenbaum to Ryan Hunt, Dan Bloom, John Wertheim, and Ben Eagle. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.